one type of antenna and taking the same radio out to the mobile and doing it out there. There was a difference.
And now what's doing is to listen to extraneous signals on an FM receiver, which has got a real limiter and discriminator, it's kind of hard to figure out what's going on. If there's some way you can listen to that signal in the sideband or AM mode, it would give you some more clues. It does suggest that the home antenna, which is probably on top of the house at a higher location, is picking up more of this extraneous noise. That's a guess on my part. 10 dB or so more extraneous noise. So you seem to be seeing a significant desensitization. And now what's causing it? Is it Mother Nature? Is it the same morning, noon, and night on Tuesdays versus Sunday because the ionosphere is always going up and down? Is it intermods because of two transmitters on the air in your town? And those transmitters on the air making an intermod are not going to be there 24/7. So as a function of time and a function of location and a function of different kinds of method of detecting and listening to it, so to speak, you're eventually going to find out where it's coming from. That's a lot of dBs worth tracing down now, Joe. Good luck with that project. I'm going to go over to Ed now, who has been standing by for a long time.
Let me throw one last thing at you.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm looking at the schematic of various different motorola radios, and it looks like on some of them, the AGC actually reduces the RF gain in the front end. That's where they get into the overload detection from. So there's that. Oh, and the other thing is, did you get that Rode white paper that I sent you?
Yes, I did. Reasonably well done. And of course, another person mailed me another white paper recently in which he's calculating the amount of coupling between antennas on the same mast. But, yes, I thank you for that. Rather well done. Rode does a good job in almost anything I do, and I thank you. That goes into my my list of good references. Ed, KC2PYT. Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz. What would you like to talk about tonight? KC2PYT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2EOD, quick. KC2TZG, quick question, too.
Okay, TVG, I can tell that EO is there, but we're only going to hear 30% of your words, EO, I'm sorry to say. TVG, you have a question on the subject that's on the floor? Go right ahead. Give us your full call and your name, K2RIW.
K2RIW, Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Zulu Golf, name here is Joe, located in Brooklyn, New York. I've been listening, and the interference also is the same thing like the cable boxes that are on the pole. I noticed that if I'm in the front and I have the HT on or I have the radio on, I do pick up a little interference from some of the boxes. I move away from the cable boxes and the interference goes away. So there is a filter that has to be put into some of the boxes that are up on the poles. Even when you pass by, like some of the transformers that are on the poles that bring in the electric into the homes and into the QTHs, same scenario. They have to. It's all about the. You got to put the filter in.
Put shields.
Yeah, Mr. TZG, good information. And as Joe does his investigation of where the extraneous noise is coming from, 24 dB of extraneous noise. Let me put that into context. 20 dB is 100 to 1 power ratio. 23 dB is a 200 to 1. So let me take a, it's roughly 250 to 1. In other words, the amount of noise coming in as antenna is 250 times higher than the amount in power than the noise coming out of his signal generator when it's running as a 50 ohm signal generator, so to speak, into his receiver. So it's still a pretty big number. He's eventually going to find out what it is, in my opinion. It's going to take some more searching. Electromagnetic interference searching is not easy. There's an art and science to that. Ed, KC2PYT. Grab it before somebody else does. Go right ahead, Ed. K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the four beeps.
KC2PYT. Okay, my question tonight has to do with voltage standing wave ratio and solid state transmitters and why people get verklempt over high voltage high vis LARS. My understanding is that when you've got a high standing wave ratio, if you pump a lot of power into your system, the reflected power ends up in some fashion overwhelming the final amplifier stage of your transmitter and destroying it. And so my question is, what is the physical mechanism of that destruction? As I understand transistors, there is a breakdown voltage where if you put too high voltage across the wrong terminals of the transistor, you essentially get arcing through that transistor. The electrons start to go the wrong way, and it causes physical damage that then destroys the transistor. Is that what is happening when you have too much reflect power? I have difficulty picturing that system and the waveforms that end up putting that voltage, that high voltage, on the out, you know, the terminals of that transistor.
Well, most of our modern day no-tune 80 to 10 meter solid state transceivers have a built-in protection circuit which measures the percentage of reflected power, and with 95% accuracy, so to speak, it protects the final stage by cutting back the drive or turning off the transmitter entirely if your reflected power exceeds some particular number. What now you're asking is that if that protection circuit wasn't there, or if it doesn't operate fast enough, what's the method of destruction? And I can think of about two or three methods of destruction. Number one is that if you've ever done very much tuning of a solid-state transmitter, and if you ever did a transmitter pulling test, in other words, by one means or another, you put a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 3-to-1 standing wave ratio load on your transmitter that's under test, and now you have a trombone in between the transmitter and that load. And by operating the trombone device, which is a kind of a line stretcher, you're now forming a reflection coefficient that goes all the way around the circle, 0 to 360 degrees of phase angle of reflected signal from your 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 testing load device. Let me drop. When you do that with the average solid-state transmitter and you're monitoring current drawn by the final stage, quite often during that pulling test you'll find certain critical phase angles where the final stage will draw almost twice as much current as normal. It's not putting out more power per se, it's drawing twice as much current. As such, it's got twice as much dissipation. So thermal runaway within the device, if it doesn't have a real good heat sink and a very low thermal resistance between the real device and all the thermal resistance that exists between it and the outside world, that's one method of destruction. Another method of destruction is so-called secondary breakdown, which you sort of was mentioning. Certain kinds of bipolar and FET-like devices, when you exceed the voltage on, into the collector or the drain, whichever it is, bipolar transistor or FET, at certain phase angles, the reflected voltage is adding to the voltage being generated by the device, and the voltage there can easily double and maybe even go beyond that, maybe even triple. So when you get a higher than normal voltage on your output terminal of your solid state device, it can go into a secondary breakdown. And a secondary breakdown is where your device starts acting a little bit like a silicon controlled rectifier. It becomes a fraction of an ohm from source to ground, and now if there isn't some other kind of current limiting resistor or current limiting constant current regulator for the final stage, let me drop. For cost reasons, almost nobody in the transmitters you and I can buy have a constant current device, constant current stage, in between the power supply and the final stage to protect you from secondary breakdown. But if you did, when it goes into this secondary breakdown condition where it becomes a fraction of an ohm, rather than a zillion amperes being drawn by that final stage, which is going to burn a hole in the real device internally, your constant current limiter would protect you, but that's not there. So that's at least two of the methods of breakdown. I guarantee there's a third. So the bottom line of this is that in the case of a tube, you reflect voltage in a tube transmitter back to that tube, the voltage becomes a little bit higher. Rarely would you get arc over, draw some extra current, and the plate just glows a little bit redder, so to speak. Tubes are extremely forgiving by comparison to transistors. So that's some of it. I bet you there are other people who can mention other kinds of breakdown mechanisms by which you can destroy your frontal stage. So as I turn it back to you, Ed, drag your feet a little bit in case anyone else wants to give us further information on this. KC2PYT, with some delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Victorial, I make a comment. Wouldn't your third one just simply be a matter of power, where it wouldn't break down the transmitter completely, like right away, but it might take a very short amount of time? If you're running a Class C amplifier and say it's 80% efficiency, the difference between what it draws to what it puts out, that 20% of power, or whatever that power happens to be, your reflective power would add to that, and the device may only be able to handle so much wattage as far as dissipation.
Yeah, I think you're mentioning latent breakdown. There's various ways that you can overstress a device with electromagnetic pulse voltages and whatever, such that it doesn't fail immediately, but it's got some internal damage that suddenly builds up, and you get a failure at a later time. Latent failure is one of the things that you're mentioning. Eric, I bet you know of some other failure methods, because some of those super high power transmitters, solid state, that you worked on, I'll bet you they've got some fancy protection circuits. KE2EJ, K2RIW in TechNet, wait for the four beeps. I shouldn't have to tell him.
So as far as broadcast transmitters go, usually there's what we call a three-stage lockout, where you'll set a predefined visual, which will actually shut the transmitter down, wait a moment, try it again, the condition is still there, shut it down again, wait a few more moments, and then try it again. If it fails there, it just goes off and stays off. Lightning is a good one. Well, the thing that I wanted to point out is in most solid state devices, like typically the 100-watt amplifier, the 110-watt amplifier, the computers that we're using right now, they use MRF 658. And you look at them, okay, there's 12 or 24 volts on the collector. If it's bipolar, these are sets actually, it's on the drain. The power supply is essentially connected directly to it through a choke, so there's no constant current source for it. But if you were actually to pop off the transistor and use one of your microscopes, you'll find about 12 individual transistors that are all wired in parallel. That's why you get these partial failures on some of these devices. The devices are not actually a single device. There are a whole bunch of devices that are exactly the same. They're usually from the same slab of silicon that they cut it up. They're all wired independently, and they sit on this heat tab, which is either a heat sink, however you couple the thermal connection to the chassis. That's the way most modern stuff is, even lower power stuff. And by the way, the breakdown voltage of most of these devices is quite high. They make it deliberately high for being in a bad environment. But again, of course, there's all the protection circuitry around it. One of the other big killers of transistors, of course, people don't realize is sometimes you have an ALC, if you're talking sideband, or some type of beep.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, because of timeout, we lost the last 10 seconds, Eric. So, by using devices that have a much higher voltage rating nowadays that are available, in the early days, those higher voltage devices were not available. RCA, I think, so to speak, perfected the technique of an overlay transistor. There were kinds of transistors you could buy, 2N5016, I seem to remember was one of them, but I'm not sure, where you could have an extremely large number of transistors inside the package, all running in parallel, with a whole bunch of gold wires bonding them all together. And yes, you could get failures with some of those, and the wires themselves were sometimes carefully laid out so they became a partial impedance matching device for the input terminal, the output terminal. But what's going on there? Let me drop it. Is that if you look at the actual emitter base, you know, base to collector junction within bipolar devices, for instance, there's probably a similar thing going on with the gate of FETs. The RF energy at extremely high frequencies flows around the perimeter of the fingers that makes up the base lead, we'll call it. And so by having a whole lot of transistors in parallel, you're putting in a whole lot more fingers, and the current is really flowing around the perimeter and not going through the center. It's kind of funny that the effect that I see with reference to broad conductor antennas that are made for broad bandwidth applications and what they do with transistors, there's a degree of similarity there. Nowadays, there are transistors being advertised that you're familiar with, Eric. You're probably going to mention a few of them to us, where the manufacturer guarantees that you can put a direct short circuit, a direct open circuit on it for a certain length of time, and it will survive that. They're starting to make them extremely rugged along those lines by building them for much higher voltages, much higher currents, or much higher dissipations. By putting some extra margin in there, they're building a lot of protection that in the past we never had. KE2EJ, K2RAW, the TechNet.
K2RAW, KE2EJ. Well, for $168, you can get this thing that looks like a chip. It's smaller than a module. It's about the size of an MRF-151, if you know what that looks like. It's nothing to do with that. It will generate a kilowatt. They have two versions, one that they call protected, and one which is not. The one which is not is a little cheaper. The one which is, I can show you some nice YouTube videos that are available, where they put a short on the end of it, and they watch the entire circuit board pop over and burn up, and then take the device out and put it in a new little socket on another circuit board, and it works perfectly fine. And they do that with an open too, so those devices are there. And we're talking at kilowatt level, so, you know, we're talking about 600-700 volts on the darn thing. And then when you put a short on the end of it, you're doing a good job.
Question for Eric. Yeah, John recognized, I got a quick question first. At the rate we're going, particularly at HF frequencies, where now you can, in theory, build devices that can tolerate much higher currents, much higher dissipation, much higher voltages, I'd like to believe once those devices become a little bit more manufactured and cheaper, that the final stages of our transmitters will have those, and therefore this persnickety characteristic where our 80-10 meter rigs, many of them will not continue transmitting beyond a 1.5 standing wave ratio. Well, only 50% of the ham population is able to achieve that with their real antenna. So I'd like to believe that sometime in the near future, we're going to be buying 80-10 HF rigs, which no longer have this ridiculous limitation where the transmitter, just like back in the old days with tubes, it'll tolerate an 8-1 standing wave ratio. Do you think that's possible? If we vote with our pocketbook, can we amateurs make that happen, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Well, K2RAW, K2EJ. Well, that's beginning to happen already. There was a company called Tokyo High Power that went bust, but they started out with the VHF, UHF, 1 kilowatt chip. And then they made an HF version of it. I think somebody else is starting to make an HF version of it now. There is one limitation that we don't talk about where you just say you open up your pocketbook, and that is economics. If you're going to make an amplifier of any kind, you have to provide filtering. You've got to make sure that the harmonics you generate aren't going anywhere. So that's where your limitation is. They tend not to want to spend money on a piece of number 8 wire, and instead they'll use a number 12 wire to make the coils. You know, they'll use capacitors which have a lower breakdown voltage than what they really could be putting in there. Let me write a drop. In the broadcast world, it's almost like their devices are all had, and the protection around them, even though the devices themselves protect everything, they still provide, you know, real protection for the transmitter as a whole, because it might be a 5 kilowatt transmitter, a 10 kilowatt transmitter. 10 of those chips in it, or 5 of those chips in it. That's good engineering practice, too. So, K2RAW, K2EJ.
So, better transmitters are coming down the pike. Some of the very first solid state rigs we could buy in the very beginning, they had terrible receiver sensitivity, terrible receiver dynamic range, very persnickety transmitters that had to have extremely high VISWARs, extremely low VISWARs.
extremely high reflection coefficients, and therefore you're forced into using antenna tuners. KQ2WGB, go ahead with your question, John. KQRIW.
And so we have Dick comment.
KQ2WGB. Thank you, Dick. I have a quick question for you. In those transistors that you were mentioning where they have multi-elements, many in parallel, any manufacturer design them with individual fuses for those circuits to protect each transistor so that if one of them shorted, the device would still work? Of course, you know, a little less, but anything like that going on? Or have you seen anything like that? Back to you.
I'm sorry, John, I didn't get all that.
I want a little drop. Okay, Eric, those transistors you were mentioning where they have multiple transistors and they're all in parallel, did any manufacturer ever try fusing the individual transistors in there so that if one shorted, the device would keep operating, of course at a lower level, but was any protection like that ever offered? Back to you, Eric.
Well, actually, that's the way they kind of work. Usually, one or two of the little chips blow up, and they open. They could short, but usually you have so much available current that those little wires are going to burn up when they do short. So, just the nature of the way they're designed, they tend to do exactly what you're saying.
Okay, thank you, Eric. Dick, back to you, sir.
It sounds like they use the natural fusing characteristics of the way you build an overlay transistor with all these parallel wires, and that gives you a little bit of protection, but you're not supposed to be going, you're not supposed to be going into that environment. Although, if you truly try to put in a fuse in an RF circuit, there's lots of people who will get unhappy with you, because the way a fuse works is it has a finite amount of resistance in the fuse, that when you exceed a certain current rating, the dissipation within that resistance of the fuse causes it to heat, that element melts, and it becomes an open circuit. So you've got an intentional lossy circuit in a fuse. So the combination of an intentional lossy circuit on the base leads and an intentional lossy circuit on the collector leads, lowering the efficiency of your transistor, which gives you a partial protection some of the time, that's not an easy one to sell. The worst case situation I know of is that one of the geosynchronous satellites was put up there in 22,300 mile orbit, and the power supply had a fuse in there to protect the power supply. And sure enough, something went wrong in the satellite where it drew extra current. The fuse blew, the power supply was protected, and now the satellite sits there inert. And there's nobody to go up there to repair it. So there are cases where you use a fuse, you're doing the absolute worst thing in the world. Let me drop. There's a whole class of power supplies that are called current fallback power supply. When you put a direct short circuit on the power supply, it flips into a mode where it draws very little current, but is drawing some amount of current where it is sensing the short circuit. And if the circuit that became shorted at some later time cools off and corrects itself, the circuit and the power supply current fallback mode senses that and then goes back to normal operation. So the power supply can be self-protecting without being self-destructive in the manner that happened. And so there was a huge investigation after that. I mean, with all of the design review meetings that took place, how come nobody saw the fact that there was a fuse in the circuit? Well, those guys had worked on circuits with fuses for years and didn't realize that on a geosynchronous satellite where there is no repair capability, that's the crazy thing to do, and it's not the right thing to do. And one of the things that I brought to Paul's attention, the VS2N, our space expert, is that now there are a number of proposals, I think Elon Musk may be one of them, where they're proposing to build a robot-like satellite, which is going to go out there to the geosynchronous satellites and refurbish them, put fuel back into them, and make minor corrections and so on. To send a human being there, no way in hell. To send a robot there, very expensive, but possible. But some of those geosynchronous satellites are worth so many hundreds of millions of dollars, a good fraction of $1 billion, that it's worth building a robot that can go out there and repair them. that, in my opinion, Elon Musk is going to realize that the two great places where he can really make an impact. One is reusing all of the boosters by having the booster come back and land on ground again or in the water where you can really reuse it. And another one is to do a repair mission. Let's see. I think make a brief attempt, Rich, into EO. I know we're going to have trouble hearing you. Part of the problem is that when you move around so that you get a good reception from this repeater, it's not necessarily the best place where we can hear you. N2EO wants to make a comment. K2LIW, the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, if you're copying, I just wanted to say hello to everybody. And I'm supposed to go home this coming Friday or Saturday, which is very good news. And I have a lot of nice things I'm going to be doing. One of them, myself and Patty St. Jeremy are going to be going to a Yankee game. Keep copying me, Dick, and I'll just stand by.
Yes, we did. I did copy you, Rich. Your signal was about 50% noise, 50% audio, and you're going to be going to the Yankee game, and you'll be coming home this coming Friday from the rehab center where you're at, and good luck with all of that. I wonder if we finished everything you wanted to hear at KC2PYT. You didn't send it back to you for any fills. K2IW and the TechNet.
Yep, I got everything I was looking for and more. I'm going to shuffle off to bed and have a great night, everyone. KC2PYT.
Okay. The next person who was on our list was Wes N2XJN. Wes, I know you mailed to me and John and also to Roy some information about a very fancy power storage device. I didn't get a chance to see it very much because I think you sent that to us this afternoon. So it looks like by way of using sand, silicon, in some exotic way, a person has discovered what looks like a method of storing a whole lot of energy. Right now, when it comes to running an automobile, for instance, the most energy-dense material that we can think of, in many cases, is petroleum. The 120,000 BTUs per gallon you get out of a gallon of oil. Let me drop that. It's a huge amount of energy. And you try to build an electric automobile that has the same amount of energy density. By energy density, I mean kilowatt hours or joules per pound or per cubic meter and so on. Nothing comes close to petroleum. That's the reason why we've been using it for as long as we have, and we're going to be using it for a long time to come. So battery research is a huge need for making batteries 10 times more energy density than we've got already. And they come with certain dangers. You make a battery that's super dense, and if somebody makes the mistake of putting a short circuit on it, look out. You're going to get smoke and flames and lightning, so to speak. So I guess you want to tell us a little bit about what you've discovered along these lines, Wes. N2XJN, K2IW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Okay. I'll just make sure that I wait for babies. The were few things that happened during the recent history. The company Bloom Energy, those guys have powered Google and eBay. Bulky installation, it does a transfer gas, natural gas, to the electrical energy, and that is being done by a clever employment of slice battery cells. The Bloom Energy used a solid oxide fuel cell that would be SOFC, could be more efficient, and it would at the end give you, they have installation 200 kilowatt, 200,000 kilowatts. That would be 200 megawatts. Yes, 200 megawatts. And they have a small installation. They plan on putting... And plan on putting on the market something that would be suitable for average Joe, and that would be 7 to 8 kilowatt power. And the only thing is that their server that they have installed in few locations for the commercial clients cost between $700,000 to $800,000 per unit. So it would be a few servers required. They think that they can have something that would be priced $3,000, and that would be home site server at 1 kilowatt. So because it's recommended 5 kilowatts to 7 kilowatts per household, we would estimate that 3,000 times 7 or 3,000 times 5. In the meantime, there was another company, Redox, R-E-D-O-X, and Power Systems, made by them, are called Cube, and they claim to be able to build something that would be 800 per dollars per kilowatt to install it. So now $800 per kilowatt times 5, you have the average price. But then you got to find out how much the natural gas is going to cost you. They use different kind of technologies. One of the technology is proton exchange membrane fuel cell. This one is known as polymer electrolyte membrane, PEM, and is developed to transport application as well as for stationary fuel cell applications and portable fuel cells applications. It is good in one thing because it operates in the temperature 15 to 100 degrees, and a special polymer electrolyte membrane operates on the simple principle of electrolysis. So you actually use water. In membrane you could use the water, split it to HHO, which is hydrogen, hydrogen, oxygen. You are interested in something that gives you the energy or carries on energy, so you put the fuel in and you have air out. At the end of it, you might have air, heat, and water out. Another form of fuel cells is solid oxide fuel. This one is electrochemical conversion devices to use electricity directly from oxidizing fuel, and is characterized by the electrolyte material. It has a solid oxide ceramic electrolyte, which is good because the technology that, if I'm not mistaken, used by Bloom, use platinum oxide, that platinum cells with that are using in the sandwich oxide. In other words, if you deliver from one side the gas, it goes to one slice of the sandwich, and by then is being turned to the electricity in the middle one, and at the other one you have that one is the X hub. Now the advantages of oxide fuel cell is that it has high efficiency, long term stability, fuel flexibility, low emissions, and is cheap. The largest disadvantage is that it operates at high temperatures, which is good question. About 1,000 degrees, 400 to 1,000 degrees. I'm trying to go shortly to each one. Another one is polymer electrolyte membrane electrolysis. And that one is electrolysis of water. So that's what I was shortly trying in the meantime to talk about it. The cell is equipped with the solid polymer electrolyte, which is SPE, and is responsible for conduction of protons, separation of product gases, and electrical insulation of the electrodes. The PEM electrolyzer was introduced by a few companies, and it actually gives you a low current density and low pressure operation currently by plunging the alkaline electrolyzer. The importance of that technology is the production of hydrogen that could be used as energy carrier. Now, as far as I remember, my experience with it is very easy. I don't recommend anybody to play with it. It's dangerous. A bucket of water, two electrodes connected to the battery. You could have a little bit of salt in it, and then shortly you're going to see bubbling. So that bubbling that you're going to see is HHO, it's split water, two gases. So hydrogen, oxygen. Now, if you now, instead of putting your matches and create the flame, you put the hose into it, then you could accumulate that gas and create the torch. And that torch is giving the temperature hot enough to make the tungsten red. If I remember correctly, the temperature of tungsten is 3,150, something like that, degrees of centigrade, Celsius. So it's pretty hot. But you can weld with it, you can cut with it, and whatsoever. So it's a cheap way. Dr. Roy sent me a few emails, and I do appreciate Dr. Roy giving me his input in it, and he has very much interesting input on it. But first to you, Dick, and then I'm going to go further. Or maybe Dr. Roy would be willing, because he sent me the message that if he's here, he's going to be here and to interview.
Wes, I'm going to have to stop you. The letters that John and I get tell us that our listening audience will only tolerate a certain amount of a one-way report. You're doing some very nice research on energy storage devices, energy generating devices, but it's not the usual question and answer two-way communication that the people who listen to the TechNet really desire. I'll turn it over to Roy if he's there to make comment on this, but other than that, we're going to have to move on, because there's only a certain amount of reporting of the kind that you're giving us, Wes. There's only a small amount of that in a certain number of minutes that this particular audience will tolerate. That's what the letters that I hear that are sent to me are saying. Roy, if you happen to be there, go right ahead. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2GS, thanks for the opportunity. I think all this is a little bit overhyped, personally. These things are energy conversion devices. They're not energy sources. And whenever you talk about hydrogen or biomass gas, you got to wonder where you're getting all this energy from. You got to get it from someone. So that's the problem I have. As a pseudo battery, it's great technology. It's very interesting. And hopefully it'll get more and more efficient. But it's not an energy source. It's just a conversion mechanism. And the prices aren't for the energy. They're just for the converting devices.
So I think you're saying it has a limited history so far. It's a little bit similar to a person who buys a fully electric automobile. And his first concern is how many miles am I going to get on a charge? The next concern that he's so thorough enough is how many hours it's going to take me to recharge. I mean, ordinarily, you empty the tank of an automobile, you go to a gas station, and in 3 minutes, you're full of energy again after you pay the guy, and you drive for the next 500 miles. In the case of an electric automobile, there's two limiting factors. It might take you 8 hours to recharge your batteries, and the energy's got to come from somewhere. You're still paying Con Ed, Loco, or whatever. So I think you're saying these have a way to go. They're interesting, but we're not likely to jump on this bandwagon immediately in our own home and in our own automobile, is what I think you're saying, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The bottom line, you have to build a whole bunch of infrastructure for biomass gases or hydrogen gas, and then you have to figure out a way of containing it because it's explosive. So there are a lot of additional expenses. Right now, Google and these other companies are getting big tax write-offs for this use of fuel cells. And I don't know if it's quite practical yet. It's more of a public relations ploy at this point.
Thank you, Roy. And I didn't get a chance to read your email yet because I started reading my email too late this afternoon. Okay, we're going to move on to the next chapter of our segment tonight, which is the mailbag. KC2WGB is the guy who collects all that mail from sometimes some really brilliant students. Occasionally we get a guy who wants us to do his homework for his college physics class or electrical or microwave engineering class, and some of those are fun. So are they going to stump us this week, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Could be, Rabbit. We'll find out. Have a nice question from this young man who listens to us on a scanner. And his question is, he's heard you talk about the anechoic chambers and, you know, some of the leakage that happens and how it's very difficult to stop all of the signals. He's wondering, why don't they build them underground? He seems to think that when you're dealing in microwaves, I think the depth of Earth would be an assistance. Maybe you can answer that, Dave. I know they're big, but we have large underground structures. Why isn't it done that way? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
The biggest chamber that I did work on, which is one of the largest ones in the United States, is the one at Edwards Air Force Base. It was roughly 1.5 acres of floor space. Seven stories high, 70 feet high. Yes, you could build a great big excavation in the ground. And by the way, there already was a big excavation in the ground. The rotator mechanism for that turntable, the turntable was something like 120 feet in diameter. You could put a whole B-1 bomber on its jack stand on that turntable. The turntable was flat to the floor. All the machinery that ran the turntable, all the machinery that fed in oil and power and air and everything else was all below grade, so there already was a big excavation. You could, in theory, make an excavation where the whole darn chamber is underground. And now you'd have to worry about what happens in a heavy rain, because twice a year, the Edwards Dry Lake, where Edwards Air Force Base is located, gets flooded. And so when you get a couple of feet of water across many square miles of flat land, how do you stop that water from seeping through the ground and pouring into your chamber? So, let me drop this. Without a doubt, you would get greater shielding by building it underground. It would make a huge expense. It would create a huge risk. And what's the benefit? The chamber as it is right now has 100 dB of shielding. 99% of the time, 100 dB of shielding is more than sufficient. A broadcast station on the outside of that chamber with an extremely sensitive receiver on the inside, you can barely tell that it's there. The majority of the testing with the electronic countermeasures or equipment that you put in that chamber, the signal that leaks out of the chamber 100 or some odd dB down is going to be so weak that somebody flying a satellite 150, 200 miles above you is not going to get enough signal that he can really figure out what's going on. So the shielding is more than good enough. I led you to believe the shielding was not sufficient. Let me drop. because last week or the week before, I was giving you the mathematics of the Voyager spacecraft. Voyager because it is so many billions of miles away, roughly three times the distance to Pluto away. The free space loss is 320 dB, as I remember. And the shielding of the chamber is only 100 dB. So if you wanted to simulate the insertion loss of 12 billion miles of free space, and you want 300 and some odd dB of shielding, yeah, but you don't have to do that kind of a test. I mean, in the case of Voyager, you know how many watts it's transmitting. I think I calculated something like 10 and a fraction watts. You know the gain of the antenna that's transmitting it. You know how strong the signal is from it at 8.4 gigahertz. You know how many miles to you, therefore you know how much free space loss. You know how much gain you're getting out of the receiving antenna at Goldstone, the 70-meter diameter dish. You know how much sensitivity that receiver has. You put all that mathematics together. Let me drop it. You put all that mathematics together, and you're able to overcome 320 decibels of free space loss. So, logically speaking, you'd like to think that, okay, in order for me to test the system, I have to have a 320 dB shielded room. Absolutely not. A hell of a lot of that receiver signal strength that overcomes, a hell of a lot of that gain is the 70-meter diameter dish at Goldstone and also in Canberra, Australia, and also in Spain. You don't have to simulate that. You can test that. You can test the quality of the dish by listening to a satellite signal or a radio astronomy signal. You can test the transmitter for Voyager by putting it in the right kind of chamber and measure the real gain of the antenna and the real power output of the transmitter. So step by step, you measure how much signal can the satellite transmit, how much signal is required for the 70-meter dish to receive it, and yes, that all together overcomes 320 dB of free space loss. That doesn't mean you need a chamber of 320 dB. A chamber of 100 dB of shielding is more than good enough 99 and a fraction percentage of the time. With great expense, you could make a chamber with greater shielding, but that chamber built with bare bones techniques in the beginning was $65 million. You could spend another $65 million and put another chamber inside, but you don't need it. So I made it sound like it's required in order to do a true end-to-end test. Let me drop this. But the true end-to-end test of 12 billion miles has at the speed of light a round trip time of a day and a half. We're not simulating that in any kind of a chamber. We're not going to have a day and a half delay light, if you know what I mean. And you don't need it. So as long as you have faith in your physics that you're testing step by step, you build up a ladder of confidence that the whole system is going to work, even though you haven't done a 12 billion mile end-to-end test. Mother Nature supplied that for you automatically when you sent the satellite out there. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, it makes excellent sense, and that is expensive. I mean, to build something like that 300 feet underground, which is what he was suggesting, it has some problems getting the aircraft in. The ramps would have to be awesome, and that's another point of entrance. But I don't know what the attenuation of 300 feet of Earth would be, but it has to be at microwave frequency. I'm sure it's very high. But, yeah, good answers, and I'm sure he understands. All right, let me let it drop, and we'll go on to the next one.
WS2N.
There's a guy who knows how to make 320 dB of insertion loss. Go right ahead, Paul.
I know I've heard you talk about that place many, many times. Do you think it's still there after all this time? Do you think they still use it?
Absolutely. You Google the word Benfield Anechoic Facility, and it used to be called Air Force Anechoic Facility. In the beginning, it was called AFAF, AFAF, we pronounced it. And then Mr. Benfield was the guy who died testing one of the aircraft, and so it became the Benfield Anechoic Facility. Oh, yes, without a doubt, it's being used. Once you spend the money to build a chamber that big, and you've got a zillion kinds of aircraft you want to test, I've seen a C-130, I've seen a B-1B bomber, I've seen fighter aircraft, all kinds of things have been put in there. It all also has a crane from the ceiling. A seven-story high inner chamber volume. You can hang a fighter aircraft, call it an F-15 if you want to. You can hang that from the ceiling and do various tests on it and squirt signals at it. So is it being used every single day? I don't know. But I guarantee it's one of the major facilities as part of the testing hardware that's at Edwards Air Force Base. Edwards is one of the major Air Force testing facilities in the United States. Eglin Air Force Base is another one off Florida, and I've been there a little bit. And the Navy has their favorite testing facilities, like Point Magoo and the one in Maryland. I can't remember, but Patuxent River, Pax River, they call it. So your Air Force, your Navy, and your Marines all have their favorite testing centers. And once they've established the hardware to do that kind of testing, you're not going to throw it away. Even if you think you're not going to use it for the next 6 months, maybe you mothball it a little bit, but you don't throw it away once you've established something that big and with that much capability. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
That sounds great. It just must be fascinating to stand in the middle of it. All right, very good, Dick. Thanks for that. Back to you.
Yeah, you draw a funny picture. When you build an anechoic chamber with a whole bunch of these radio-absorbing pyramids around the floor, ceiling, and everything else, if you stand in the middle of that chamber, it also is an acoustic anechoic chamber. That's the quietest room you've ever been in your life. Your buddy could be across the floor a short distance away, and he shouts at you. You might not hear him. You're looking at him, you see his lips move, and you might not hear him when you're in that chamber, Paul, because the environments you and I normally live in, when a guy is down the hall 100 feet away from you, you're getting all kinds of acoustic reflection from the ceiling, the walls, and the floor. But you put those two people 100 feet apart in a thoroughly anechoic facility. An awful lot of that audio that you think you're going to hear becomes very hard to hear. So strange. It's a strange feeling to be there. I can tell you some other funny stories that happened along those lines, but later on. I guess if you think we've answered that one, John, it's time to go on to the next one, KC2, WGB, with that great big mailbag. It's Mr. Santa Claus. K2RIW, very John.
KC2WGB, yeah, you know, I have a good use when they abandon that. They could make a library out of it. That would be very nice to be in a library that quiet. All right, let me let drop and go on to the next one. Okay, this gentleman is discussing the use of some bird meters. Now, he knows that when he's using his 100-watt transmitter or transceiver, he has 100 watts slugging the bird, and when he's measuring reverse power, if he wants to increase sensitivity, sometimes he'll go down as low as 50. But he realizes that it should be, 100 watts because things could happen. His question is, he has two birds. He has one between his transceiver and his tuner, and one between the tuner and the antenna. And it's a 1kW amplifier that's involved after the tuner. And his question is, does he have to worry about measuring reverse power on the first meter between the transmitter and the tuner when he's in the reverse mode? If something should go out of tune on the tuner, could that cause him to burn out his slug in the first meter? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. I hope I described it sufficiently.
Okay, there's a little bit of confusion here, John. Almost nobody owns a transceiver that runs a kilowatt. Almost all of our transistors run...
It's 100 watt, Dick. He has a tuner, and he has a kicker at a 1kW.
Okay, up to now, you only talked about the transceiver, the two bird watt meters, and the tuner. And somewhere, a kilowatt was being created, which wasn't mentioned. Okay, so let's get the whole schematic here. Transceiver, first. Bird watt meter, number one. Afterburner amplifier, tuner, and then bird watt meter number two. Is that approximately it? Is that the layout? Is but totally out there. Eric, I mean, John, go ahead.
That's it, Dick. You got it, and the antenna, of course. So now, if the tuner does not do its job, can he damage the reverse reading first bird meter?
I think the answer is almost always no. That afterburner is high power amplifier. That probably takes something like 50 watts input, and by way of its 13 dB of gain, it gives you a kilowatt of output, rough numbers. It has a forward gain of 13 dB. Because that amplifier is unconditionally stable, obvious by the fact that it doesn't break into oscillation, it doesn't have the condition, which occasionally happens, where you turn off the exciter and you're still transmitting a signal because your afterburner is oscillating. Almost all afterburners used correctly are unconditionally stable. Because it's got 13 dB of gain, that means the reverse gain, in other words, if you feed a signal into the output terminals of your afterburner, the input terminals are going to get a signal considerably weaker than 13 decibels attenuated. If that wasn't true, then the whole thing would break into oscillation. So you probably have 20, 25 dB of loss in the reverse direction. So therefore, let me drop it. Your afterburner is a little bit like an isolator. An isolator is a microwave device which allows the signal to flow in one direction and has a huge amount of attenuation for the signal that wants to flow in the opposite direction. One of the nicest kinds of isolator in the world, in many cases, is an active amplifier, whether it be an operational amplifier, whether it be this afterburner. So, of the kilowatt that that afterburner is capable of creating, I'm going to round off the numbers and say that it probably has a reverse power ratio of minus 20 dB. Minus 20 dB will take the kilowatt of output, and if it ran into a short circuit and all of it fed back, I'll bet you at the input terminals you wouldn't see any more than, let me pick a number, 10 watts. 10 watts would be 20 dB down, by the way, from a kilowatt. So your input circuitry is protected. Now, how this all got started is that on a couple of occasions I mentioned the fact that a really enthusiastic guy using a bird watt meter will say that I've got a really good moon bounce antenna. Good job. And many of these guys with a moon bounce antenna, using a special temporary authority that they have achieved, that they have received from the FCC, are radiating numbers like 1,500, 2,000, 2,500, 3,000 watts. As long as the antenna is aimed up in the air, they're allowed to do that. So they might have 3,000 watts of forward power, and they've got a 3,000 watt slug to look at it. And because the antenna is so carefully tuned, the antenna might be giving them a 1.01 standing wave ratio, where the reflection coefficient is 30 dB down. That means when it's producing 3 kilowatts of output power, the reflected signal from your antenna might be 3 watts. And so, in order to resolve the 3 watts, because you want to know, if you're a real scientist, you want to know the exact amount of reverse power, it's very tempting to put in the 3 kilowatt slug to measure forward power, and then put in the 3 watt slug to measure reverse power. It sounds like a logical thing to do. I strongly recommend you do not do that, because it turns out the slug is really a directional coupler. There really is a termination built into that slug. Let me drop it. That slug is a directional coupler. It maybe has a 20 dB of coupling coefficient, so that a small fraction of the power going forward is picked up by the slug, directional coupling characteristic, and it has directivity. It ignores the power in the reverse direction, because the directional coupler used backwards is still picking up minus 20 dB of signal. It's still a directional coupler. By the way, whenever you make a directional coupler for, let's say, 20 dB of coupling coefficient, it has exactly 20 dB of coupling coefficient in the forward direction and the reverse direction. Every directional coupler has the same amount of coupling forward and reverse. You're about to ask, okay, where the heck is the directivity coming from? Let me drop it. Every reasonable directional coupler is a four-terminal device. It's got the main input terminal. It's got the straight-through line to the main output terminal. Then it has the other two terminals, which are the coupled line. The coupled line is parallel to the center conductor field line picks up an equal amount of signal, where the signal flows